not by prearrangement, but accidentally meet there and have breakfast together occasionally. And one morning we met and had breakfast together and were reading the Wall Street Journal when there was an announcement that the government was going to sell the synthetic rubber plants. And this had required a special act of Congress. They had set up something called the Synthetic Rubber Plant Commission. They had appointed three well-known civilians to run the thing, had borrowed people from all the agencies, and they announced these sales. And we read this and decided, well, you know, if we want to go into some new business, here it is. Decide we should bid. And we looked down the list, and there were good reasons not to bid on most of the plants, because some of them were run by Exxon, by Goodyear, by Firestone, and you just felt there's no point in bidding against them. But one was, there was a big butadiene plant that was being run by Sinclair Oil. And Sinclair has since been acquired by ARCO. But even at that point, Sinclair was not a red-hot operation. We thought that if we've got a chance to get any of these, the Sinclair one is the one. And so we put in a bid without any knowledge at all, but it was obvious that the bid didn't mean anything. The bid was just the beginning of a long process, a long negotiation process. And we bid $8 million because that was a number we thought was respectable, but not enough that they'd give it to us automatically because we didn't know what we'd do. And this started a long negotiation process with this rubber reserve. They called it the Rubber Reserve Yes. Commission. With that group, and I think that I probably negotiated, you know, that I think the contracts we negotiated and I negotiated probably set the pattern for most of the others, because for some reason our deal sort of got in the front with, you know, with the lawyers. And so this lasted, this was almost a 6 or 8 month exercise. And I spent half my time in Washington, and a lot of the time over with these people. At that point, I'd never seen a butadiene plant. I had to go to the handbook, you know, to find out what it was and how you made it. But, you know, you learn as time goes on. And we were the successful bidder. And then simultaneously with that, Paul Davies was pretty much of a one-man show. And there was a man in Houston named Gardner Simons who ran something called Tennessee Gas, which is now Tenneco. And they had grown up together and were good friends and gone to the Harvard Business School together and were bosom friends. And they decided that they'd make this a joint venture between FMC and Tenneco. And we had a meeting the same day we closed the deal in Washington to set up the joint venture. And they had a long discussion about how we would operate. And I made a note at the time, which I found a long time later, that neither of them understood what the other one was saying. And so the thing started out without a good understanding. We set up a separate organization for Petrodex. I went down to represent FMC. Tenneco put a man in, and they retained a guy named Joe Mayers, who had been a Monsanto vice president, to sort of be the, he was called the managing director, chairman or something, but he was relatively inactive. And within 6 months after we got started operation, maybe about that, first the business just just took off. The rubber business picked up to a degree nobody ever expected. And so we started making a pot full of money. And the two principals, Davies and Simons, had a falling out and they never spoke to each other again until they both died, not speaking to each other. And they fell out over a very interesting thing that made no sense at all. We put in a Hoodry dehydrogenation unit. Butane was a feedstock, and at that time the only use for butane was to put it in gasoline in the wintertime to increase the vapor pressure. You didn't need it in the summertime, so there was a big market for butane in the winter, not much market, none in the summer. It wasn't a desirable home heating fuel. Propane was better. So butane would sell for 2 or 3 cents in the summertime. It was a drug on the market. Nobody had developed storage for it, and it might sell for 10 cents in the winter. Tenneco put in a butane recovery unit and was selling us butane, and we were paying them 6 cents a gallon for it, which was a reasonable year-round price. And Paul ran into someone he knew in the oil business and asked him what the price of butane was, and he said 3 cents. And that was the summertime. And Paul was paying 6, we were paying 6 cents, and that led to a discussion where both of them said things they probably were sorry for, but never. Anyway, Petrotex. I stayed at Petrotex a long time. It was a very successful operation, but it clearly wasn't going anywhere because the two owners didn't get along.
Now that started 50. Was that 55?
Yes.
Okay, so there's that. Essentially, the 4-year period.
It was a 9-year period that I stayed at Petrotex.
Okay, but prior to that, then 51 to 55, you were with FMC. Is that right?
My guess is it was closer to 52 that I went to FMC, but I'm not
okay.
Sure. Anyway, I was with FMC looking for things for them, mm-hmm. and at least a year of that I spent on this on Petrotex.
But that's a long 9-year period.
Well, it is, yeah. And in hindsight, I probably shouldn't have stayed there that long because it was a dead end kind of thing. Both FMC and Tenneco went their own ways, but I was happy. I married when I was 43, and I was happily married. We were comfortable in Houston, and I had nobody was bothering me much at Petrotex, so I stayed in the course of this, made 2 trips to India to set up to work on an Indian synthetic rubber plant, and this turned out to be an interesting thing too, because as you probably know, butadiene is made by dehydrogenating butane. It's also a byproduct of ethylene cracking and things like that. But during the war, because of some reason, someone had developed a process for making butadiene out of methanol. Are you an organic chemist? Well, you convert it to acetaldehyde, you condense the acetaldehyde into into 4 chain carbon thing, and then dehydrogenate it. And there was a plant built up in Louisville, Kentucky, to make butadiene out of alcohol, and it ran and made butadiene all during the war. The Indians decided they wanted a synthetic rubber business, and they invited Goodyear over to talk to them. And since Goodyear was our main customer, they asked me to go with them. So I went with them as the butadiene expert on this trip. And we spent a month in New Delhi and places around. And I've never run across anybody, any group of people who knew as little and thought they knew as much as the Indian bureaucrats that we had to deal with. They would tell me all about how to make butadiene and all about the economics, and they were determined to make butadiene out of alcohol up in northern India at a town called Bareilly. And we went to Bareilly, saw the site. That's where I saw the sulfur burner in a sugar mill there. And it was obvious that this was the wrong place to build it. It was the wrong raw material, the wrong process, wrong everything. And in the course of it, I met the Goodyear representative there. Had been the son of one of Nehru's close friends. So in the course of it, I got to meet Nehru several times. We went back 6 months later, spent another month there, and we decided to not to fool with it. The thing was so badly conceived. Somebody else, Firestone, got involved in it and built it, and the plant ran 5 years or so and finally was shut down because it was obviously the wrong place, the wrong everything. But anyway, I probably should have left there sooner, but as I say, I was happy at home. I was not under any pressure. It was, and I might have just stayed there and coasted. But in 1964, Conoco, who was also headquartered in Houston at that point, the man who had been running their chemical business died suddenly of cancer and left them with no apparent successor. We had a consultant. We shared a consultant that would work for both Petrotex and Conoco, named Herman Neuenhaus. I don't know if you've run across anything. Herman was a former Shell Dutchman who had a very successful consulting business in New York, mainly sort of bringing European technology to America and vice versa. Anyway, he is the one who made the connection between me and Conoco. Conoco at that point was run by a man named Leonard McCullum, who was very much of an entrepreneur. And he and I got along. We met, got along fine. I went to work for them, stayed there for 6 years. When I went there, their chemical business was losing a few million dollars a year. When I left, it was, I don't remember, but it was probably making, the profits were probably more than the sales had been when I went there. He was very supportive of what I was doing, and we bought a vinyl chloride PVC business, built a VCM plant, built an ethylene plant, had a operation in Germany, one in Spain, one in Japan. So it was really quite an interesting thing. And
you were essentially managing the chemical.
I was running this business, and effectively I did. This was all things I did. Then in 1968, my wife died of cancer after about a 2-year illness, and Mr. Mack retired, and the sort of the accountants types took over, and I decided at that point that I would do what I planned to do, and so in the middle of 1970, I left. And I left without any particular plans. I left on good terms with everybody, but I just decided it was time for me to move on. I came back to Houston, and the first thing that happened the day after I announced I was leaving, one of my investment banker friends called and said, "We invested in a company that's having trouble. Would you come look after it for a little while you're deciding what to do?" And that started a 6-year career of looking after about 3 or 4 high technology. There was a collision avoidance device for ships, a gas chromatograph company, a computer control company, nuclear chemical thing, and a company that made test gear for the Air Force.
In 1975, Standard & Poor's Register lists you as, well, there's ATEC.
ATEC was one of the companies. That made the instrumentation that the Air Force uses in the test units for engines, where they, you know, they test engines.
Mm-hmm. There was the computer application technology, which...
Yes.
And then Iotron?
Iotron, that was a collision avoidance device for ships. And those have been acquired by other people. ATEC still is still running as a separate company and is moderately successful. But
some of these are, at this point, you're now getting away from the chemical
business. I know. So I spent 6 years out of the chemical business, which in hindsight probably was a good thing. Because when I went back in it, I had a sort of fresh point of view. And I went back in the chemical business, Petrotex, because of this joint ownership and because the owners didn't get along, slowly went downhill. Mainly because nobody would make any decisions. And so something had to be done about it, and they got together and asked me to come and run it. And so I agreed to run it if I got a free hand. The deal was that I would tell them what I was going to do. They would have 10 days or 2 weeks to tell me no, but if nobody said anything, I did whatever I planned to do. So I went into Petrotex, and it, at that particular point, it was losing a lot of money. And all the thought was, what can we do? Can we convert this into a storage facility and salvage some money? But it owed $35 million. It was making 800 million pounds of butadiene and losing money for a very simple reason. There was a lot of byproduct butadiene coming on the market. And so what Petrotex was doing is they lost more money, they'd make more butadiene. The more butadiene they made, the more they'd drive the price down. And so they were just digging their grave with their... And the first thing I did was to shut down 700 million pounds of this capacity, and we went from losing money making 800 million to making money making 100 million because... Shutting down, the price went back up. It went up to a reasonable number, and so it did. And then I also sold. They had very stupidly gotten into the neoprene rubber business, and we sold that to Dinka in Japan, and paid off all the debt. So, at the end of 2 years. Petrodex was doing well. Tenneco bought FMC out. They wanted me to stay and run it, but I didn't want to be a Tenneco employee. And almost simultaneously, a company in Houston called Alaska Interstate had an operation in Alaska that distributed gas in Anchorage in southern Alaska, and so they were interested in Alaska. The state of Alaska announced that they were going to offer their royalty crude to anyone who would build a refinery slash petrochemical plant in Alaska, and the decision on who to award this would be based on who would do the most for the Alaskan economy, effectively who would create the most jobs. And a dozen people bid on this, and Alaska Interstate was bidding on it and had an all-out effort to do it. At that point, the chief counsel of Alaska Interstate was a good friend of mine. The chief financial officer was a friend. Some of the directors were friends, and they would occasionally call me and ask me what I thought about this. And I forgot what I told them, but at any rate, the guy who was running this for him died suddenly of a heart attack. And they asked me to come in and hold it together, which I did, and then I got interested in it, agreed to stay, and I made a deal that this required the governor's approval. The governor had to choose the right person, the right group, and the state legislature had to ratify it. And I agreed to stay through the state legislature ratifying it. They agreed to pay me a substantial bonus if I did it, and so I did, and had some fascinating experiences. Alaska is a great place. If I were young, I'd go there today. But dealing with the Alaska legislature was just like dealing with small town courthouse politics. In the course of time, the governor. We were chosen as the one, but we had to get approved by the legislature. The terms of the bill were such that if they didn't approve it at this session, the whole thing lapsed and started all over. Mm. And we got down to the last day of the legislature. The Senate ratified it. The House was still screwing around, and they started going home in anticipation of adjournment. We sent a plane to Fairbanks to bring two representatives back, and they wouldn't speak to each other, and we had to send another plane to bring the other. Our lawyer, who's a very bright girl, woman, who's now the wife of Ted Stevens, a senator from Alaska, was our lawyer. She went on the plane and persuaded an Eskimo legislator to come off with his wife and mother-in-law and all their houseplants to come back and vote. We had one of our supporters in the Red Dog Saloon who got in such state that when he went to vote, he pushed the wrong button and voted against us. But we got it done. And then Alaska Interstate decided to sell this project to a company called Charter Oil, which was a sort of a high promotion operation in Florida. And I didn't want to get involved with them, so I took my bonus and pulled out and started thinking about what to do. And I decided the next thing for me to do was to buy a medium-sized chemical operation and sort of spend my last years looking after it and sort of semi-retirement. And so I started on this, and I tried three or four or five things. Gulf Oil at some point acquired a company called Harshaw Chemical.
Oh, yes.
About as illogical an acquisition as ever been made in history. Harshaw was a catalyst maker in inorganic chemical business. This happened a number of years before, but by the early 80s, Gulf decided they wanted to sell it. I tried to buy it. A dozen people tried to buy it. Gulf consistently asked about 25% more than it was worth. A year later, they'd come back and offer it a lower price, but still too much. And finally, they sort of merged it with Filtrol and probably got essentially nothing out of it. Well, that was one of my failures. I tried to buy a chemical business that Tenneco had that made plasticizers and things like that that Herxt bought. The closest I came was I was going to buy the Conoco carbon black business and the Phillips carbon black business and combine them into one business, and there were enough savings and research and overhead to pay for the thing doing it. And I got the thing all together. I had a deal signed with Conoco, and then Phillips backed out at the last minute because it would require them to show a loss because we weren't paying very much for it. And this came unglued. And along the way, I decided, well, hell, I quit fooling with these small things. And why don't I go back and try to buy the old chemical business that DuPont bought? And so, to back up a minute, on this Alaska deal, we had two bankers helping us. One was Lehman Brothers, and one was E.F. Hutton. And at that point, E.F. Hutton was not a powerhouse in the financial business, but the man they had on the job was exceptional. He was just much smarter than the Lehman people. And so we got to be friends, and when I started looking to buy something, I enlisted him to help me raise money. Well, I didn't need any money raising, but when I decided to approach DuPont, I knew the DuPont people, but I knew they wouldn't, if I walked in off the street, they wouldn't take me very seriously. And I'd kept up with this, to digress just a minute. One of the things I had in Conoco was a fourth interest in a company called PASA in Argentina, which at one point was the biggest petrochemical thing south of the equator. It made ethylene, ethylbenzene, styrene, butadiene, synthetic rubber. And when I left Conoco, it had always been a mess. It was started poorly financed, poorly managed, and when I got ready to leave, nobody in Conoco wanted to be responsible for it because they were afraid it would fold up. So I made a deal with Conoco to continue to represent them in Argentina, and so I went to Argentina every 6 or 8 months for 20 years. But it also kept me in touch with the chemical people, so I knew pretty much what was going on. So I decided to take a crack at DuPont and buying the chemical business from DuPont. And the man they assigned to work with me at Hutton turned out to be a good friend. His personal lawyer was a man named Joe Flom, F-L-O-M, who is sort of the dean of the acquisition lawyers in the world. And not only that, the former chairman of DuPont named Irv Shapiro had just joined Joe Flom's firm. So my friend in Hutton went to Joe Flom and told him what we wanted to do. He got Shapiro, and Shapiro set up a meeting for us and then never was involved again. He set up a meeting with a man named Bob Richardson, who was one of the DuPont Executive Committee. And that's when this whole exercise I've been involved in now started. And we talked to him, and we were guys off the street, and he was very polite, very nice. Told us at the time they would consider selling it, but they were not going to have an auction. They were going to have one other company make them an offer, a competitive offer. And he set up a procedure for us to work on. And this was in the fall of 82.